Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned, what you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And...
Hello again, film fans. It's the Top 100 Project, starting with last week's coming attractions trivia question for The Grapes of Wrath. Here it was. John Ford was known to introduce himself as, "My name is John Ford, and I direct westerns." How many of his record four Best Director Oscars was awarded for a western, and name them? Okay, Bev, did you figure it out?
No.
Maybe others did. Here they are. So it was none. None of the four.
Whoa.
His four directing Oscars were for The Informer, The Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, and The Quiet Man, and none of which was a western.
Oh, how about that?
And all of those with different stars. The Informer was Victor McLaughlin, The Grapes of Wrath was Henry Fonda, How Green Was My Valley was several people, Walter Pidgeon, Maureen O'Hara, and others. And The Quiet Man, which actually did co-star O'Hara and McLaughlin, but of course starred John Wayne. So there it is. I direct westerns, but I never win awards for them. And that brings us to our Top 100 Project movie number 25. And that is Walt Disney's animated picture, Fantasia. It was 58th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between The Third Man and Rebel Without a Cause, but was knocked all the way off the 2007 list. The film was released by Walt Disney Productions and RKO on November 13th, 1940. Even though it cost more than $2 million to make, several re-releases and its initial moderate success have made Fantasia a blockbuster throughout the decades. Bev's got the skinny.
Animation is married with classical music with many different visual themes and styles, ranging from Mickey Mouse as a wannabe magician, to dancing hippos, to a devil summoning the dead.
Movie in a nutshell for Fantasia, Beethoven and Bach cash in as cartoons. Nutshelling this one was hard, no doubt about it. It's not one of my strongest ones, but... the movie was pretty strong when it came to style, when it came to looks, when it came to music, of course. What did you think, my wife?
I really loved it. I really loved it. I know. I think it's criminal that it got knocked off the list, and I know I'm going to have to defend this position with you. I don't think we have disagreed this strongly about a film yet.
There have been a few films I don't think were great, and I don't necessarily know were AFI worthy. But I don't know that I really thought one was... a bad pick is a tough way to put it. It's not really fair. But something I just think is the wrong pick. Because if you want to go with multiple Disney films from the early part of the century, then you got to go with Pinocchio. Good old Pinocchio.
Why does it have to be either or, though?
Like, it doesn't.
Why eliminate this film, then?
There maybe could have been more animated films. We've said it so many times. There are not enough horror films. There are no documentaries.
Yes.
And we've gone on about genres or films that we thought were overlooked. Animation, I think, certainly was. There's only three in total. Mm-hmm. Snow White, this one, Toy Story.
I'll tell you what Fantasia does that Pinocchio doesn't do, is it truly innovates. Pinocchio is innovative, but it's kind of doing what Snow White had already done, what they knew at that point to be a safe formula. But Fantasia is doing something that's innovative for the time, daring, like really courageous and gutsy, beautifully executed. But also, it really stands alone as being the only non-narrative film on the entire list, the only visually abstract film on the entire list.
Oh, debatable.
Well,
I can think of one right off the top of my head, and it's the other film I would say would probably work best while inebriated.
Which is that?
2001 A Space Odyssey.
Okay, 2001, and 2001 probably owes some debt to Fantasia and other...
does.
And I mean, I say Fantasia... but Fantasia, of course, borrowed heavily from other abstract films that were being made. Like, there's a whole world that isn't represented on this list or really in most cinematic criticism, which is the art world and the art of abstract film. And abstract animated films were being made at the time, and Disney borrowed heavily from them and even hired some of those artists, those animators who were working on that kind of thing to work on Fantasia. I had a prof in college who made abstract films and who loved abstract films. And we watched all these short animated, some of them were animated, some of them were kind of I guess you would say documentary style, all different styles, like true innovations, even like Stan Brakhage, who would literally tape things to the celluloid and set it to music, and people who really push boundaries. And I think probably most people don't get exposure to something that's just purely experimental in films, and Fantasia would be a lot of people's only exposure to something like this. And it's really well executed. And it's popular, too. Like, this is one of my mom's favorite movies. And my mom's no film nerd at all, you know? She has really very popular tastes. But she loves Fantasia. It was, for me, and probably for lots of people like me, something of an introduction to classical music, along with other Disney stuff as well, and even Warner Brothers cartoons. It brought the highbrow to the public, and it's not a 100% perfect film by any means, and I couldn't defend all of the segments, but I really defend its vision, and I really think for that reason it belongs on the list. Its innovation and its guts and its vision of bringing this high art to the public in an accessible way is why it belongs on the list.
Those are compelling arguments, and I don't disagree with most of what you're saying. I guess my biggest problem with it when I saw it before and when we saw it this time is I didn't care.
Yeah.
And I think I didn't care because of something I didn't know why I didn't care from what I'd remembered about it before and why I was dreading it this time. But I think it's because of the lack of a plot. I don't want to be one of those people that's hung up on plot. A lot of my favorite movies have been plotless. Scorsese, when he won the Oscar for The Departed, said, "This is the first movie I've ever done with a plot." And of course, he'd made 5 or 6 great films and 3 acknowledged classics that we will eventually do on this project, that he's arguing have no plot.
God, but if this Mean one... Streets doesn't have a plot, then Fantasia, what is it?
Okay, but I'm just saying that I don't think of myself as somebody who has a problem with that, but with this one, I just was indifferent. And this is a movie that has great classical music by one of my, my favorite composer of all time, the greatest music maker of all time, Ludwig van Beethoven. And you've also got other great names, Bach, Stravinsky, Tchaikovsky, and also the animation is certainly outstanding. Although the DVD we saw didn't look all that great.
It didn't. I was a little disappointed by
that. I really hoped I could have got the Blu-ray and I couldn't manage to snag it. And maybe it would have been nice if I had. But through all of that, I just sat there indifferent and I don't really know why, but I did.
But maybe it's just a taste thing. And that's a completely fair evaluation of the film.
I wonder if the film was watched on the wrong day. Maybe you watch a comedy, a great comedy, and you're not in the mood for it, and you don't laugh. And what do people think so funny about that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a scary movie, and you're not in the mood to be scared, or whatever it is you're supposed to feel in a movie, and you don't, and then you push back against it.
But I really just think it might be fair to say that you just don't like non-narrative. It's hard to watch it for 2 hours, too.
That's too long.
Even though the last segment is one of my favorite, and when I've watched it, because I've watched these components on their own just on YouTube, and the last one is one of my favorites when I watch it that way, but watching 2 hours straight, by then I'm just tired. And when you have to pay that close attention to the visuals, and it probably would be better if they had been kind of separated into separate ambitious pieces, but part of the reason why I got turned into a feature film at all is because it was the only way for Disney to turn a profit on this. It started with The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which was meant to be just one of his silly symphonies, but then he got very ambitious about it, and he wanted to make this kind of a silly symphony masterpiece, and it got way over budget. He had these ideas about how he wanted the sound recorded, which we'll certainly talk about, because that's a pretty important part of the film as well.
Yep.
But when the budget got out of control, instead of abandoning it, he decided to go big and create a feature film. And maybe that's a mistake.
Oh, I admire that, actually. That's going all in. That's not having the cards to win the hand in poker and saying, I'm doubling down and I'm putting all of my chips in the middle of the table.
Certainly it was Disney style. It was how Snow White got made in a way, too. It was just this ambitious movie that everybody told him would fail.
And a big gamble. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I do admire that part of it. Yeah, you're right. Mickey Mouse was supposed to have been in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is the most famous part of this film, I would say, the third segment. And that was going to be a short, like you said, went over budget. They already had Leopold Stokowski working with them.
He was so passionate about the project that he refused to be paid.
Yeah, he was willing to do it for free. Yeah. I don't know. Did you read if he actually did do it for free or if that was just, I'll
as
do this
As far as
free.
I know, everything I saw just kind of repeated that story. I don't know if he ever got paid. He's a fool if he didn't.
Okay, let's talk about the way the film was released. It was a roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard that expression many times with movies. I didn't know exactly what it meant, so I looked it up. And in a nutshell, it's kind of a reserved seating type deal. Mm-hmm. There's always an intermission. It was a movie that would be longer than a normal running time. Not that 2 hours and 5 minutes is really that long, but for an animated film, which was still a new thing anyway, it was extraordinarily long. There are no trailers and no cartoons or newsreels, which was a standard thing back then. You don't see that anymore. Movies just aren't done that way. But it was a, I wouldn't say a common thing, but it was something that happened back in the old days. It was like an event, just like we talked about with Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, Gone with the Wind.
Not long ago. Mm-hmm. It was an event. It wasn't just going to see a movie. It was a whole big deal. And that's something that you mentioned a minute ago, that Disney was aspiring to make an art film. And some people pushed back against that because they didn't like the idea of him going too highbrow. Mm-hmm. They'd only released two movies at that point, Snow White, 1937, and Pinocchio earlier this year in May 1940.
Both very crowd-pleasing popcorn films.
Based on previous works,
too. Yeah.
This is ironic, though. The soundtrack is entirely previous works because it's all classical music, mm-hmm. but the visuals are entirely new.
Yeah, but like classical music, some of the stuff that they were doing would have been considered sort of high art. The Roadshow was kind of a failure, though, right? It was so expensive both to make the film, but also to take the sound equipment from one place to another. And not all audiences responded to it. A lot of audiences, like we said, were put off by the highbrow nature of the film.
Well, they got good sales as far as tickets go, but it wasn't justified by the cost, like you just said, of the, of the setup cost. It was like having a gigantic concert for the biggest act you can think of, the Rolling Stones in their prime or something, and having such a big production setup, a stage and everything, that it outweighs the cost of what they made to put on the show.
Yeah, you can't sell enough tickets to break even. Mm-hmm. It's kind of
And people would probably never forget they saw that show, and that'd be great, but you're not making money off of it.
Yeah.
It's very gimmicky in its many incarnations. You had the Roadshow and the Fanta Sound, and that's what they called the surround sound, Fanta Sound, the one and only time that anything was ever called that. They at one point released it in widescreen. There were different running times. The movie was really cut back different times to a more traditional hour and 25, hour and 30 minute length for an animated film, which is quite a few segments they'd have to cut out to make that happen.
Well, for the record, I think most of what they cut out was a lot of Deems Taylor's commentary explaining the different segments.
One more thing they did differently in the many incarnations was they had different narrators at different times. Deems Taylor was the original. They had Tim Matheson, who was in Animal House and also was the vice president in the early seasons of West Wing. Mm-hmm. I thought Deems Taylor's narration, I'm not blaming him, but I'm just saying that that was so unnecessary. It's like they tell you how to watch the movie, which is so odd.
I didn't mind it, but it was too much. I didn't mind a little bit of explanation, but then you're right. There were some things that are so tragically obvious. Oh, Zeus made a thunderstorm. Oh, with lightning. And then I see Zeus making a thunderstorm with lightning. Like, there, for the first segment that's so highly abstracted, his explanation was both necessary and helpful to enjoy it. But when you're explaining...
I don't think it was.
No?
I think you could just put a simple key on the screen, giving the music composer credit, the original composer, put what the title of the segment was. You could have put whatever you wanted to on one or a couple of different keys. But that would have been enough for me. And then you save time. And you get rid of this live action stuff that isn't really necessary. Now, maybe they wanted to have Deems Taylor's live action stuff to augment Leopold Stokowski being on screen a decent amount of time. Because if they didn't have Taylor, then Stokowski would stand out more as the only non-animated thing you see in the whole movie. Although maybe that would be a good touch.
I liked that it added a cohesive nature to the whole movie and that it tied it all together. I know, you disagree. You're shaking your head. I agree it could have been shorter, but I would not want to do without it at all.
What it reminded me of is what we've been mocking, and especially this season, of Dexter. Where Dexter will do something, and if you're watching the television screen, you will see that's what he's doing, and his voiceover will tell you that's what he's doing.
Yeah, he describes exactly what you're watching. I'm driving down the street. We can see that.
And now I don't know the things that Deems Taylor is going to say going into the segment, granted. But I think you could figure it out. And if you want to go with an art film, then why explain this stuff at all?
I liked the explanation. You know, it's funny what the experience of watching Fantasia reminded me a little bit of last year we saw Pina, that documentary about the dance troupe. And I was frustrated by the parts that I didn't understand. And maybe I'm a rube that I require so much explanation to my art. And maybe it's meant to be abstract and impossible to understand and... But I like my art a little less opaque, I suppose, or I can appreciate it more if I can kind of understand the artist's intention to some extent. And I found that frustrating about Pina. But Pina actually reminded me a lot of Fantasia. It had these narration in between. Not really narration, but the interviews with the dancers in between the pieces. And then they played out and they were, I guess you could say, highbrow and high art.
Yeah, I would say so.
But packaged for a popular audience.
And that movie was, much like Fantasia, an experience.
Yes.
And I didn't dislike Pina at all. I would definitely say I liked it. I think I probably appreciated it more than this movie. Maybe that's the best you could do with Fantasia. Well, not for everybody. For me, at least, it would be to appreciate it. One more thing I want to say before we do a trivia question is there's somebody who once said about a Scorsese movie that you can enjoy it if you turn the sound off, or you can enjoy it if you just listen to it. Fascinating thing to think about. He was such a great, or he still is, such a great user of score and sound and sound effects, and obviously the dialogue's usually pretty good in his films. And of course, his visuals are so great. Here's an example of a movie that does exactly that thing. Mm-hmm. Turn off the music, as great as that music is, and just have it be this impressive animation. Mm-hmm. That would be one thing. Okay, now let's get rid of the animation and listen to the soundtrack in your car driving on the road.
We already know.
Which I think would actually be the thing I'd certainly rather do.
Yeah.
And yet, it didn't gel for me. And I guess I've made that point more than a few times. Rebuttal before I go to a trivia question.
I respectfully disagree.
We didn't yet say that this film had a sequel. It was called Fantasia 2000.
Yes, it was.
When was Fantasia 2000 released?
1999.
Oh, she knew it. What date was it released?
Oh, give me a break.
December 31st. I'm guessing it was released late at night, almost like it's, you know, New Year's Eve, spilling right into 2000. Because I love the fact that a movie that's called Fantasia 2000 was not released technically in 2000.
I think they probably planned for it to be a much more significant event than it was. Unfortunately, I don't think it did that well. I saw it in the theater with my mom, because she loved Fantasia so much. And I enjoyed it. But I haven't seen it since. Like, you kind of forget about it. It didn't stick with people the way the original Fantasia did.
Okay, I missed that one. Interestingly, we talk about a sequel. Disney wanted to re-release this movie regularly and change things. Either change the animated segments to go with the music that existed, or to make all new segments and to have some that existed with new ones. I don't know if he would have necessarily had an entire new film.
I think the plan was to switch them up so that if you saw it over and over again, you would be seeing a slightly different film every time. And then over the years, each segment would be replaced so that it would be a brand new film every so often.
That's asking a lot, though.
I guess, but he was ambitious, right? And he actually had started production on some of these shorts, but it got waylaid by a couple of things. One was the initial failure financially of the film. And the other was, and this is actually part of the blame of the failure of the film, is that war had started.
Right.
World War II was going on, which meant that they couldn't access those European markets, and they lost out on any profit they would have made with international release of the film. And of course, it's a great film to release internationally. There's no language barriers. There's very little dialogue. You could just easily dub over the Deems Taylor stuff and release it anywhere, but they didn't have the opportunity to. But they had to waylay production, and then I guess they never picked up where they left off, despite the eventual huge success of the film.
Well, he moved on to other projects, Disney and his people did. And they did Dumbo next, Bambi after that. And they were pretty prolific about making films in the 40s and into the 50s. It may have simply been a matter of, we can't keep up with this one. Let's move on from Fantasia.
It's funny to imagine that Disney, as a studio, used to be one of the most innovative studios in Hollywood. Because now I just think of them as this kind of profit machine.
A factory.
In a strange way. They really like, between the types of films that they make and release and the marketing of the toys and the theme parks and everything Disney, everything but the brand is just like this money-making machine. And I wonder what Walt Disney would think of it now, because he was just such a creative innovator and he had such a great vision that had to do with a lot more than turning a profit.
Yeah, he would have certainly loved to rake in the dollars, but he probably would have been surprised, at least, the way things have gone and maybe even appalled.
The way he behaved was not like somebody who just wanted to turn a profit. He took great big risks that were based on his creative vision.
Yeah. This movie, though, despite the fact we've said it didn't really truly succeed, it is 22nd on the list of top box office hits when adjusted for inflation. We talked about this extensively on Gone with the Wind. 22nd.
It's huge.
It's ahead of titles like The Godfather, The Avengers, and The Dark Knight.
That's incredible.
Although movies got re-releases. Gone with the Wind got those, Snow White got those, other movies we'll talk about got those. It does skew things a bit. When people will talk about these movies, Godfather, Gone with the Wind, all these gigantic hits, Sound of Music, and even Jaws, despite the fact it had a lot of screens, didn't have thousands of screens to play on. Yeah, but they also played
for a long time.
As we talked about before, mm-hmm. for a year or more. And they also didn't get re-released over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's just... It still happens to some extent now. I mean, they re-released Titanic in 3D.
The Star Wars movies got re-released.
Wars movies got re-released, that's right. But audiences aren't going to flock to those movies the way they used to because they own them. They can watch them at home anytime they want. That wasn't true in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
That's so true. There is a great... There are several great theaters within a bike ride for us of where we live here in Toronto. And we could go to see classic movies get re-released fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do it. I think it comes down to that exact thing, that most of them are on the shelves here in this house.
Yeah, exactly.
Or we could rent it if we really wanted to on our own time.
Yeah.
Now, granted, seeing on the big screen would be great. And we do hope at some point to do at least one movie for the project that we see on the big screen. If Lawrence of Arabia just happens to be playing mm-hmm. where we want to see it, we got to try to do it that way. Or maybe 2001. I've seen that in the
2001 is one that actually plays with great frequency.
I love taking notes during movies, which I've done for every one of these, but I think I would have to put that aside if we could see a great movie on the big screen.
That would be good.
Okay, we've gone quite a while now. We really haven't talked too much about the usual things we talk about, the stars and the director, and they really can't. Yeah. There isn't one director on this movie.
No.
So clearly this was a Disney team production through and through. Ben Sharpstein, who we mentioned on Snow White, was involved. He gets production supervision credit on Fantasia, but there's no specific director. And incidentally, there are no opening credits. There are no closing credits. There's just that one in the middle when the intermission would be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very simple title card. Very strange way of doing things.
Yeah.
That's part of the roadshow thing, though, too. I think that what they would have done would be to give you a program. I know that Coppola wanted to do that with Apocalypse Now when he mm-hmm. wanted that to be released as a roadshow, which was not in vogue anymore in the late 70s. So the stars of this movie are two characters, Mickey and Leo. Mickey Mouse and Leopold Stokowski, the only two major players on screen. Yeah, it's Deems Taylor, but he's not a star. I guess the other people you can mention would be behind-the-scenes people, like famous animators. Now, I mentioned two famous animators who were put into a movie, brief scene. It was Iron Giant. I was right about that. Frank Thomas was one of the names that was correct about that. Ollie Johnston was the other one, if I didn't say it on Snow White. These were two of the eight wise men or eight old men or something of the animation department, and they were major players in this production, too.
And Iron Giant paid homage to them.
Yep. And, of course, the majorest of major players behind the scenes was Disney, who was not a big music person. He would talk about it in production meetings that he wasn't some music genius, and he didn't necessarily know the way to tackle everything in this movie. And he certainly gave his animators and some of the technical people more of a free hand than he might have otherwise. He even let the colorists pick the colors.
Mm-hmm. Apparently part of the appeal of the music in this movie for him was that he hadn't really grown up with classical music. He, like a lot of people, considered it kind of too inaccessible. And it was what, you know, stuck-up people listened to. And so he never felt like he had this avenue to enjoy it. And when he discovered it when he was older, part of the motive for making the film was to introduce it to people and take that attitude away from it. Unfortunately, it didn't work for everybody. But that was part of his motive.
Okay, we keep talking about the multiple segments in the film. So that will lead me into trivia question numero dos.
Okay.
How many separate segments are in Fantasia?
Eight.
That was easy.
I know.
Should always give the listeners time to think.
And... I'll edit a pause with a ticking clock.
Spoiler alert. She knows it instantly. Okay, so the segments then.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous one, I would say it is certainly the Mickey theme and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, which I thought was interesting in some subtextual kinds of ways. It's pretty much just Mickey trying to duck chores.
Yeah, I know.
He's a lazy mouse.
He's just trying to cut corners. Never cut corners, kids.
And I had a question about what goes on in that. Is it possible that everything that goes wrong in the Mickey sequence is just a dream? Because he does fall asleep. The broom is doing its job that he's magically made it do.
Mm-hmm.
But he falls asleep and that's when things go crazy. Is it all just a dream?
I guess so. It could be Inception. But it certainly doesn't. It looks like there's a scene where he wakes up. So I'm going to say that their intention was that he fell asleep and that's when things went haywire. And then they continued to go genuinely haywire. It's one is your favorite? Which segment is your favorite?
It's that one. It's that one. Because I'm not a big Mickey Mouse connoisseur. I don't think I've ever seen Mickey in a movie per se. Like the shorts, the silly symphonies. I don't think I've ever actually seen any of those in their entirety. I've seen clips of them here and there, sure.
You've never seen Mickey's Christmas Carol or the Christmas shorts?
I don't think so.
Oh my gosh.
So that's my exposure to the most famous Disney character of all. One of the most famous movie characters, or at least pop culture characters of all time.
Isn't it funny how he's such an iconic character, but as you pointed out when we were watching the movie, he's never been the lead character in any of Disney's feature films. Mm-hmm. This is the closest he comes to it.
Right. And he's on the cover of the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the third segment. It's not the first. It's not the last. It's not necessarily even the best. It's just the one I like the most.
Mm-hmm. It's charming, I think a lot of people like it the most. It's the most narrative.
Yeah, and it's also the one that's the most influential on people that follow, too, people in movies and TV.
It's probably the most accessible of all the segments as well, because the rest kind of get more far out. It starts far out. I was surprised that they would have started it with what winds up being the most abstract piece, the Bach, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Bach, which is like a strictly abstract animation. I really liked it. I'm glad they started it off because you kind of need to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. You need to be sharp and looking. If that had been at the end, I think I would have zoned out completely. My favorite is the Nutcracker Suite with the dancing flowers. And oh, I mean, like that piece of music is one of my all-time favorites.
I didn't realize how many different parts of that song mm-hmm. are the Nutcracker Suite. We've probably all heard those different themes. It's almost, as much as I love the Ninth by Beethoven, it's almost more impressive than that.
Because each one is so different, but each one is so delightful.
I didn't know they were all part of that same song, though.
Yeah, yeah. I love the animation in that one, too. It kind of has that great balance between being classical and something that you can follow and you can make out what's happening, but it's still kind of abstract in the concept, you know, dancing mushrooms and the fairies, the goldfish. Like, it's really beautifully, beautifully done. That was my
favorite. It's probably the epitome of this movie, too. Mm-hmm. Even though we talked a lot about Mickey a minute ago, and maybe the epitome of what they're really striving for. But we also can't forget the blasphemous dinosaur sequence. Blasphemous because where's Jesus riding a T-Rex?
You know, they cut out, the original concept had the evolution of mammals and eventually man, but they decided to just omit it because they would rather not invite the controversy that creationists would inevitably start.
Guess what would happen if they made this movie the way they made it now?
Exactly the same thing. Actually, if they made that movie exactly the same now, creationists would still be upset because they'd be like, why aren't cavemen and dinosaurs together?
Teaming up to fight Satan.
So which segment did you like the least?
I can't think of the one I liked the least, per se. I think I just wasn't into enough to really, truly ever get into any of them strongly. Mickey one was good. The dinosaur one's memorable. The last one, The Night on Bald Mountain, is terrific. So I don't know. I can't really pick one. Actually, no, I can. I just remembered. I know it's one I like the least. The greatest composer of all time is married with fairly inferior animation. Not that the animation is not good, but it's just kind of dumb.
Yeah, this was my least favorite as well. The whole Greek myth thing. The pastoral symphony set to Mount Olympus with the way too cutesy Pegasus flying around in the Bacchanal, and then Zeus comes and he's like cheeky, throwing lightning at people. I really didn't like that one, and what a shame, because it is a really beautiful piece of music. It's your favorite composer, but yeah, that was the one that worked the least for me. But I wonder if they threw it into kind of like appeal to kids, because there's not that much to appeal to children.
And that's a question right there. Is this even a kids movie?
I would say no.
It doesn't have to be, but animation certainly at that point would have been thought of as a kids movie, and even now is accused of being a kid's genre, I should say. Not that animation has to be just for kids. Some of the best ones of recent history haven't been. But generally, people accuse animated movies of being simply cartoons, which is just for children.
I think it's mostly Hollywood. Foreign animation doesn't seem to suffer from that. Well, that's true.
Yeah, Miyazaki doesn't do anything like that. And The Grave of the Fireflies is a heartbreaking movie that is mm-hmm. not for kids at all, I wouldn't say.
I think it's always an education in a way to the public whenever the nominations for Best Animated Feature come out for the Oscars. There's always one or two films that nobody's ever heard of, and they're really grown-up films, you know. It's really an obvious example, but The Triplets of Belleville, think of that.
I love that
followed
movie.
By, yeah, oh, I love that movie, too.
Well, Spirited Away won the second ever animated
Oscar.
That is
a great movie.
And that was not, it's not really a kid's movie. Kids can learn a lot from it, but it's a very strange, unusual film
for
American audiences, North American audiences.
It reminded me of like The Dark Crystal, and the way it was just so dreamlike and almost scary, but still kind of had childhood themes. Although I don't think if I had a kid who was remotely sensitive or prone to nightmares, I would never let them watch that movie. It could be really scary, and it preys on those really deep, abstract fears that children have. Anyways, we're obviously getting way off topic. Mm-hmm. The point being that animation does not have to be strictly for kids. It just kind of seems to be because the Hollywood has insisted upon it for one reason or another, probably for marketing purposes, which is a bit of a shame.
You take a poll of 10 people on the street, though, random people, and ask them if they think that animated films, and even name 10 of them, that are not traditionally kids' films, and they're probably still going to say, well, this cartoon is not for me. Or maybe they like animated films, but they'd still say, they're for kids first and foremost.
Yeah. That's so, because most people on the street wouldn't be able to name a non-Hollywood animated
film. Well, maybe that's just the marketing, like you said, but I think that that's the stereotype that really they can't escape. All right, let me hit you with trivia question number 3, which I bet you're going to get instantly.
Okay.
Give the listeners a chance.
I'll give it a minute.
All right. Leopold Stokowski was the conductor of what city's orchestra? She does know it, I think.
Was it the New York Philharmonic?
No!
Damn it!
After all that showing off.
I wasn't showing off. It was actually thinking.
Oh, okay. It was
Philadelphia.
It was Philadelphia.
But you know what it was? It's that Dean Taylor, the reason he got cast as the MC is because he would do the intermission commentary during the radio broadcast of the New York Philharmonic.
Okay. I just think it sounds funny to hear Philadelphia Philharmonic.
Philharmonic, I know.
I have a few more random thoughts I want to throw out there about various things with the production. Now, we've talked before about nipples not being censored by the MPAA, but we almost saw full-on nudie cartoons in the Centaur sequence. And yeah. some cells were actually created where they have no top on, but the final product doesn't show any such nudity.
Some of the dancing fairies in the Nutcracker suite as well were a little sexier than maybe they needed to be. And the centaurs definitely were. Those were some slutty centaurs, just saying.
And as far as the reaction goes to that element and other things, interestingly, we just said about objectionable visual content. The Vatican included Fantasia in its list of 45 great films in the art category.
Really? I would have thought they would have objected to the sorcery in it because they tend to have a general problem with witchcraft, I heard.
Mm-hmm. But there you go. They included it. And as far as critical acclaim goes, a lot of major critics of the time raved about the movie, including Bosley Crowther of the New York Times. But music critics didn't like the marrying of classical tunes with the visuals. And they probably resented even more that it was a cartoon doing that. If you had done it with a live action film, they maybe wouldn't have liked it. But because it's the quote unquote kids movie, it must be that much worse. In their opinion, they were not fans.
Well, they should embrace anything that introduces viewers, listeners, an audience to what they're doing.
All right, so let's get into the behind-the-scenes people a little bit more. We didn't talk about some of the non-director, non-producer people of the film. You may not know this name yet. You probably will hear his name on this project. I hope so. The great James Wong Howe was a cinematographer for the live-action sequences. You don't know that name, do you?
No.
He was terrific. He did a lot of terrific films.
With the color, I mean, that was innovative in itself, too.
Excellent cinematographer. And as far as the other side of things, the sound, let's get more into the specifics of the Fantasound.
Yeah, this is important. When you want to talk about the legacy of this film, I never knew this, but this was the real true innovation of this film. It's the precursor to surround sound. Disney could almost say that he invented surround sound. He certainly was the first one with the initiative to spend the money to make it happen.
But they had to put that into theaters. They had to build that and then move it around, and that's, like we said earlier, it cost so much money to do that. They would have a center channel, which they always did for mono back in those days, and they'd have two surrounding speakers. So they'd have basically what you now have now for 5.1 is your right center left. They would have that, but no back surround.
Yeah. They also solved the problem of dynamic range, which was a problem with all recording in general, which is that, you know, the loud parts distort and the quiet parts were ruined by system noise, and that's a particular problem with classical music. So they developed a system called TOGAD, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, which audio editors and recorders use from then on to kind of solve this problem and to adjust the volume to accommodate the sound as it's being recorded. Huge innovations, like pretty important. And to force movie theaters to adapt this, it reminds me of the Jazz Singer forcing movie theaters to adapt to sync sound projection. Or, you know, in a much more recent example, George Lucas releasing Attack of the Clones only in digital projection forcing all of these movie theaters to finally upgrade if they wanted to play this film. And they wanted to play that film.
Which was a huge cost. Yeah. And something they probably balked at.
This is also the first use of simultaneous multi-track recording, so that they recorded different parts of the orchestra on different audio tracks. Yeah, different microphones, different tracks. So that when they played it in stereo sound, it would actually sound like you were listening to an orchestra, and that the noise from the strings section might be coming from a different speaker than the percussion section, and to most accurately mimic actually going to a symphony hall listening to an orchestra play.
Impressive, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Impressive and important, too.
And that, of course, was very influential. Let's get into the influence.
Mm-hmm.
A few things I noted. Obviously, it has a sequel. That's an influence right there. Mm-hmm. Fantasia 2000. Thought there were shades of Fantasia in T2. The indestructible broom sequence in The Sorcerer's Apprentice is the T-1000. You obliterate him and he just goes right back and he becomes the same thing again. In the case of Fantasia, the brooms become more, not just necessarily the same thing all over again.
But still that notion that, you know, conventional ways of destroying something mm-hmm. doesn't work.
Yeah, the more violence you use on this mm-hmm. thing, the less it works. And also the fact that the movie had no credits, which was unheard of then, and now it's become a standard thing for a movie not to have opening credits. There's always a long list of closing credits in modern movies, we know that, but there's no opening credits almost all the time now. But back then, it was just absolutely unheard of to do that. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, we've said that so often. Well, it was actually a Nicolas Cage movie a few years ago, which Disney released. Fairly mediocre.
In fairness, this story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice was not new to Fantasia.
Hmm.
It wasn't written by Disney. It was a pre-existing story. It was based on previous material. The music had already been written specifically for that story. So.
Yeah. And I think we said this already, but that sequence in particular in this movie and other sequences, I suppose, too, have been parodied in many places in many ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Most animation that's really lived on probably has been, to be honest. A lot of the movies we'll cover in this project, you can't really say have been imitated by our favorites, The Simpsons, for example, or many others. But animated films generally find a way into those kinds of pop culture icons of the modern era.
Maybe it's because it creeps into your brain when you're a kid, and there's something about that those images and those stories that you learn when you're a kid that just always stay on your mind and always become a big part of your influence as an adult. Maybe that's it. Although, so as far as a purely abstract, non-narrative, strictly episodic movie like Fantasia, there's nothing else like it on the list. There's very few movies I can even think of that remotely resemble the form that Fantasia took. So you can give it credit for its, and I obviously give it credit for its innovation, but as films go, you can't really say it's been highly influential to other films. Like even though it made money, it didn't. Nobody else really tried to replicate it or copy it.
Well, it's like an anthology film. You see those every once in a while, but not a lot.
Not a lot, no. But I will give it credit. Maybe not for directly influencing other forms of filmmaking, but there's probably a lot of animators who did see this movie, who went on to make creative short films, who went off to maybe push the envelope a little bit harder in what they did, and we already used 2001 as a good example. I'll also say, as an example, look at music videos. Look at things like Pink Floyd's The Wall, Yellow Submarine, White Stripes Fell in Love with a Girl, Peter Gabriel's Big Time. These are all animated music videos, and they're all like pretty out there and experimental, and I'm not saying Fantasia's directly responsible for that, but there's probably no living animator that wasn't somehow influenced by Fantasia.
I think I'd enjoy that a lot more in a 3, 4, 5,
short 6 minute format. Really does work better in this. It's hard to ask an audience to sit through something that's that abstract and challenging for that long.
Yeah. When there's no real stakes.
Yeah, there's no plot to keep you engaged.
Yeah. I remember you said in the Frankenstein podcast that you would be happy to knock it off the list as a horror film and replace it with Rosemary's Baby, I think was the example you used, or Night of the Living Dead, or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, for me, I think I said this right at the top, knock this sucker off and put Pinocchio on there.
I disagree. I respectfully disagree. I like Pinocchio too, and I love Dumbo, actually. Dumbo was always my favorite when I was a kid. It's probably of those old original Disney films, it's my favorite, but I would still totally defend Fantasia. It belongs there if for no other reason than its daring uniqueness.
I bet a lot of listeners would say Bambi is another one.
Yeah,
I'm not a fan of
that favorite movie. I think
that movie's way overrated, but
yeah, I've never even liked it as a kid. I think even as a kid, I was like, it's a little over the top cutesy, wouldn't you say?
And I probably said on Snow White, I'm a big fan of animated films. I've got so many of them. We have so many of them on the shelves in this house, but we don't have this one.
I'm going to ask for over Christmas just to bug you.
All right, the awards. Another AFI lists section. Fantasia was fifth in the animation category on the top 100 genres list. It made the National Film Registry in 1990, their second year of doing that. And it got two honorary Oscars in 1942, not at the 1941 Academy Awards, interestingly. Leopold Stokowski got one, and Disney got one of his record 783, whatever number he actually won. He is the record holder for Oscars.
Yeah, that's true.
That anyone's ever won, and it is in the, I think, the 30s or the 40s.
It's ridiculously high, yeah. Good luck anybody catching up with him.
Many. Before we wrap it, I'm going to say one thing that is a complete rave. If I didn't already do this, I'll do it now. It's five words for this film. Tchaikovsky, Bach, Stravinsky, Schubert, and Beethoven. They are brilliant.
And I, once again, I will point out that for a lot of people, at least myself, my first experiences with classical music always came with cartoons, whether it was Fantasia or Silly Symphonies or Merry Melodies. My dad, sometimes on Sunday mornings when he wanted to wake us up because we were all sleeping in, he would blast... what's it called? See, I can't even remember the name of the song. I think it's called Ride of the Valkyries. Dun, 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 dun. See, because we always called it Kill the Wabbit, Kill the Wabbit. We never knew the real name of the song. And I know that's not Disney. I know it's a totally different studio, but I think the spirit is there that this nature of movie introduced classical, really beautiful classical movie to young minds, that when you should be learning to appreciate it and when you shouldn't be finding it intimidating. Instead, they put it in the least intimidating possible way, which is like melded with cartoons with some of your favorite characters.
Well, Chernabog at the very end, the devil, the demon at the very end, did scare the living crap out of kids.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah, he was terrifying.
And the Night on Bald Mountain sequence.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily a thing that...
That's true. Fantasia isn't 100% that. I'm just giving animation in general credit for bringing classical music to the world in a way that I don't think other genres of movies really have.
Okay. So, the coming attractions. Trivia question. Here it is. On the list of top 100 box office hits when adjusted for inflation, there are three animated films ahead of Fantasia. They rank 10th, 11th, and 18th. What are those films? If you know it, do not say it now.
Okay. I'm going to think about that, though. I'm very curious.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one.
One is a big surprise. The other two, maybe not so much. And we'll have one or two other trivia questions on the site. But that's about it for Fantasia, and this is the last animated film on the Top 100 Project until 1995's Toy Story. The only other animated film on the list, and it wasn't on the first list as Fantasia wasn't on the second.
Oh, so maybe they replaced Fantasia with Toy Story in a way. We always indirectly say that happened. It's also the last color film we're going to see for
quite of the 50s. Time. All through the rest of the 40s now, black and white.
Yeah.
But some great titles. I can't wait to see some of them. Okay, so up next on the Top 100 Project is the star-studded rom-com classic, The Philadelphia Story.
With one of my favorite classic movie stars, Katharine Hepburn. In the meantime, four more from Ryan and me, including trivia about Fantasia and other movies that we have podcasted, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And